Hello and welcome to The Nature Between Us, a podcast for all your eco inquiries and musings. My name is Tessa. I'm an Aussie actress, voiceover artist, and environmental master's student on a mission to demystify the big environmental issues of our time. Join me on my quest to find solutions and positivity from the wide variety of people working towards a more sustainable future. This podcast is recorded and produced on Bidjigal and Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, and I acknowledge the traditional owners and pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. This is episode number 6, and I'm delving into the climate crisis, but not with the usual scientific facts and figures. Instead, I wanted to know how Australians feel about climate change on an emotional level. Are they terrified, ambivalent, interested, or is it all just too much? Well, turns out there are people who are experts in understanding how we feel about things. And I'm not talking about psychologists. I'm talking about social researchers who understand how we as a society behave and react. And one such person is today's guest, Rebecca Huntley. Rebecca is one of Australia's best known social researchers, having delved into understanding some of our most complex social and generational issues. She holds degrees in law and film studies, along with a PhD in gender studies. Rebecca is also an established author who's written numerous books and essays and is a regular commentator on radio and television. A few years ago, Rebecca turned her focus to the climate crisis and produced her latest book, How to Talk About Climate Change in a Way That Makes a Difference. This book was one of my favorite reads this year because you might be like me in thinking that the facts are the most important part of the climate change discussion. But as Rebecca explains, that's not always the case. We need emotions too. In this episode, we dig deep into the psychology of the human brain to explore how we really feel about climate change, why it's sometimes hard to engage, and how best to tackle such a tricky and scary conversation. I hope you enjoy.
Hello.
Hi, Rebecca.
What an auspicious day for us to be speaking.
Oh, sidebar, this was recorded on the final day of the American election. So if you hear us referencing Trump or the election, that is why.
I know. Have you been following? I haven't really tuned in this morning.
I've been following enough, but to follow it too much is just to stoke one's anxiety because we can't even donate parties or causes in America, which is what I found out after Trump got elected. I decided that every week I would try and donate to organisations in America that were fighting him, and then they kept returning my money because they say, you're a foreigner, you can't.
Oh my gosh, I didn't actually know that.
No, it's true. And in Australia, foreigners give money to our political parties. We actually have at the federal level, less transparent election funding laws than America.
Wow.
We don't know. We have no, when people say, oh, fossil fuel companies don't have any influence on politics, I say, well, we don't know because we don't know how much they give.
That is crazy.
We certainly don't know how much they're giving in the election period.
Yeah.
We only know 6 months after, which is irrelevant.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's a whole other story. So I'm following it but not thinking about it.
Yeah. Well, I guess a nice place to start before we dive into discussing your new amazing book, How to Talk About Climate Change in a Way That Makes a Difference. I wanted to get a better understanding on what exactly your job entails as a social researcher.
Yeah, so I've been a social researcher for about 15 years, and I really started as an academic and a writer, and my first book was on young Australians. So I'm going to use this term and sneer, Generation Y. This is like over 15 years ago. And that really was just lots and lots of interviews with young Australians, and it was off the back of that that I kind of stumbled into the social and market research industry, which was an industry I was only vaguely knew about. As somebody who'd done law done a PhD, I kind of saw myself kind of going into academia, but even then it wasn't a very sure thing really in Australia. So I kind of stumbled into social market research, which is a large industry which does all kinds of things. It mainly does what most of your listeners would understand as surveys or polls, yeah, which is pretty much the same thing, although when we talk about polls, we often think about political polls. Mm. But kind of surveys, which kind of measure attitudes at scale. So, you know, you always got 1,000, 2,000 people who'll respond to a survey, and that if it's a proper survey, it'll be weighted to represent the population. But I was primarily a qualitative researcher, which really reflected my, you know, interest in interviewing people and listening and analysing words. So I'm not really a numbers person, although I've learnt to be one over the years because I've worked with lots of what we call quanties, data guys and girls, data guys and girls. So basically lots of what, again, your listeners would understand as focus groups, but also interviews, all other kinds of ways that you really kind of measure how people feel. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, it's been 15 years listening to how people feel about things, Australians across the country, all kinds of Australians on all different topics, and I've just loved the work. Mm. And what often happens is that the different clients that we have that commission that work use it to better understand their business, what voters want from them, what citizens want from them. So I've worked for all levels of government, local, state, federal, to really kind of hone in on how people are feeling, what their expectations are, often how to influence them. You know, they want to get them to buy a product or buy a service or alternatively respond to a campaign, mm, right, or become a member of a union or donate to a charity. So they use those insights, both quantitative and qualitative, to kind of market, build strategy, that's the kind of thing. So you become a professional advisor, mm, to different kinds of organisations. And I was lucky over 15 years to work pretty much with, so, you know, every sector of the Australian economy, all kinds of organisations, big and small. And so I got a really, very intense experience seeing how different people use information to make decisions. That's basically mm. what I do. And now I just do that for the climate movement.
Yes. Oh, yeah, you've had an absolutely incredible career. And it is an interesting thing when one skill or one kind of job title can kind of merge over many different industries, like you're kind of like slipping in and out, and yeah, it almost sounds like the original or like the in real life Facebook kind of data.
Yeah, well, that's true. Well, in a sense, you know, people like me, I don't think our jobs have been, they've been undermined by things like Facebook, in that now Facebook, Google, all these kinds of organisations can not only harvest all of what you're saying about yourself, but actually see what you do.
Yeah.
How much, you know, what you buy, whether you go to porn sites or not. And I remember one time, I used to work for one of the big supermarkets. I worked for both of the two big supermarkets, and one of them, you know, had such a massive loyalty business, right? So just because so many people were, you know, using the supermarket, and they'd be able to get information about what they were buying. And one of the guys said to me, "Oh, we know if a woman's pregnant before anybody else, including her husband, just because of the nature of we can monitor what she's buying, right? So we can kind of see the changes in what she's buying." It's probably a bit of an overstatement, but I think it's right. Like they can see how people change, whether they lose a job, worry about things, you know. And so now lots of businesses are turning to this, to big data, to let them tell a story. But they still kind of need people like me, because it's never the complete picture. We do understand. So you can say, oh, this person is changing in this way. But until you spend a lot of time with people, and that thing that machines can never do, which is really read a whole lot of other subtle signs, which you can only really get when you spend time with people, that's the other missing piece, right? Mm. And of course we know, and we're talking, Tessa, right at the minute as Americans are doing their final voting, even the most sophisticated data can't necessarily measure big really subtle but important and new surprising shifts in the community. So there was a couple of, there were a couple of researchers that thought maybe Trump would win the last election, but they were out, they were kind of outshouted by everybody else. Now they've changed some of the things that they're doing. We realise we live in an even more uncertain world than we ever have. So what does that mean? It means that people like me and people who do big data and people who do surveys and people who do all kinds of things come together and we essentially try as much as we can to build the closest picture we can to the truth, whatever that, however close you can get to that right now, and then think about how things might unravel in the future or how they might progress in the future.
Yeah. Oh, I have so many questions about that, but I don't
want to dive. Focus on climate change. Very important.
Yes. Well, you just said that you collect all of this data and you want to understand how people think and feel.
Yeah.
And you've recently, or in the last couple of years, shifted your focus onto really understanding how Australians feel about the climate crisis.
Yeah.
So tell me, how do we feel about the climate? Do we have a consensus? Yeah. What do we think?
So one of the, speaking of, as we were just about the failings or the blind spots in traditional social and market research, measuring things like how people are going to vote, right? It was in the last federal election in Australia. That was the first moment professionally where I realised, look, we've got over 70% of Australians saying they're really worried about climate change and they want governments to do something. And yet, sometimes at a state level, they'll elect a government that's got relatively good climate policies. But we've consistently voted for a federal government that it doesn't take that as seriously as they could. And in fact, ignores a whole lot of conventional voices and voices in business to change. So I'm thinking, well, what's happening here? And that's when I started to think we need more precise, sophisticated tools to understand all that kind of second and third and fourth level on top. So there's the, I worry about climate change, it's real, government should do something. But what's lying underneath all of that? And what are the barriers to people having that feeling or belief and then actually walking into a ballot box and putting a number against the candidate who takes that seriously?
Because are they two very different things?
Very, very different things. Or alternatively, caring about climate change and then saying to your superannuation fund, what are you doing? Are you still investing in coal and gas given all the, given that the movement is towards renewables? Or to what extent are you saying to your power company, what's your renewable plan? Why is it so much more expensive than your conventional plan? What are you doing? How are you investing? All those kinds of things. So they are two different things, because people are, and I write a lot in the book, a kind of a mix of rational and irrational, emotion and reason. We always have been and we always will be, and different people sit along that spectrum in different ways. People are complicated, which is why hopefully I'll be in a job for some time. If they were really predictable. And I used to work for a company that talked about predictability, unpredictable. I think people are predictably unpredictable. That's the reality. Although we do have ways to understand a little bit more about why we understand why people act almost retrospectively. So when things happen, like when Trump gets elected, not this time, but last time, we can all look back and go, oh, my God, that makes sense. But in the middle of it, it's not always absolutely certain.
Yeah.
So I realised after the last election we needed more precise tools, and that's when I came across a really fantastic piece of research that comes out of America, out of Yale University, called the Six Americas. So what it does is it basically categorises or segments different bits of the population into categories, I suppose. It sounds awful, like sorting people into star signs, but it's a bit more sophisticated than that. It's a way to understand why different people feel the way that they do, right? And it kind of classifies them and moves them into segments based on how they feel about climate change, what they're doing now, what they're prepared to do in the future. And then when that happens, you start to see some kind of patterns. in terms of things like, if you're really, really alarmed about climate change, there's a good chance that you're much more educated, not smarter or wealthier, but much more educated than somebody who is dismissive about climate change. Now, that's not to say that the one person is smarter than the other. It means that potentially somebody who is alarmed about climate change, when they listen to a professor or an expert or somebody from the CSIRO and they say, this thing is happening, they're much more likely to respect and understand the expertise and the work it took to get to that point. Whereas somebody that's never been through that process realises, oh, maybe that person's just saying that, you know, or maybe it's because of their political bias. And it's like, I can honestly tell you, having spent a lot of time with scientists, their data is far more important than their political bias, right? If they're not finding something, no matter whether they want to find it or not, they don't find it. They're just, you know, they're credible. So this segmentation, so I went to Yale last year, looked at the work that they've done over the last 12 years, looked at the extent to which organisations of all kinds use that segmentation to target audiences and market, and to target audiences and make sure their messages around climate change in terms of behaviour change are really bang on, right? And I thought, we need that in Australia. And so I came back and was very lucky to find some funders and have been involved in a project called Climate Compass, which we're now talking about, which will go on for the next 5 years, which really shows there's about 7 different groups in Australia when it comes to climate change. But at least 6 of those groups are really, really enthusiastic about renewable energy. So that's the good news. Anyway, so there's lots to talk about that. So that's what I'm doing. I'm doing that kind of instead of just, oh, everybody thinks climate change, you know, 72% of people think climate change is real and we should do something about it. This is something different, a much more precise tool for advocates and communicators on climate.
And what are those 7 groups? You said 6 of them are positive on renewables. I'm curious how that, what are they?
Well, the group that we would normally describe as climate deniers, we don't call them that, we call them dismissives, because they just anything, any evidence put in front of them, no matter what kind of evidence and where it comes from, they just block, right? It's about 9% of the population, so very small. Oh. And in fact, all segmentations that I've seen that have been done show people that fit into that deny category almost always in the single digits. They're a really tiny percentage of the population. And there's lots of different kinds of people in that 9% because it's still a lot, you know, numerically, but they tend to be older in Australia, tend to be older, tend to be men, and are almost always conservative. So everybody else sits, so the other groups, which are doubtful, disengaged, cautious, concerned, alert and alarmed, sit along a spectrum of concern, not just concern about climate, not just belief about climate change, because most of them generally believe something's happening. So it shows you that for at least 90% of the population, the argument isn't, is the climate changing? The argument is, how much, at what pace, is it going to affect me personally? And what can we do about it? So I would say to anybody listening to this, and often people say to me, should I argue with a climate denier? And I would say, look, you might be like me. I have a limited amount of energy and time. I have 3 children. I have a house to clean. And so I think, do I want to spend my time convincing 90% of the population, not about climate science, but about what we can do? Or do I want to spend my limited time arguing with a tiny percent of the population about an issue of which they will never agree with me? So where should I direct my energy? I should direct my energy at the people who don't need to be convinced it's happening, but need to be convinced we can do something about it. And that's 90% of the population. So that's what I would say. Like, that's what the numbers show us. So everybody else sits on this spectrum from alert to doubtful. I suspect, Tessa, without making you do this survey, you're probably alarmed.
I am alarmed. I'm highly alarmed.
But it's worth understanding those other groups, because we don't want to spend our whole time, as lovely as it is to do this podcast with you, I don't want to spend my whole time talking to people who I furiously agree with on climate.
For sure. Yeah.
Except to say to them, how do we support each other in the work that we're doing? How do we make sure that we don't fall into despair, anger, and all the rest of it? My job is to get people like me and people like you to understand and empathize with all those other segments, all those other kinds of people, not to judge them too harshly, because that's not a good starting point for a conversation or persuasion, and say, what is it, even though we all feel quite differently about climate change or on that spectrum, what is it that unites us? What is it that brings us together that we can have a common agreement about? And there's three main things. One is that although we play a role as consumers and citizens, corporations should do the right thing, particularly corporations with high emissions. The responsibility is with all levels of government, particularly the federal government, to do something about this. And the agreement is that renewable energy is a far better investment than coal and gas, and that we should make that transition. The question is how quickly. So, and the question is for all of those groups, how quickly and at what cost, who bears the burden? But the agreement is renewable energy, government investment in infrastructure unites all of those groups.
Yeah.
So you have, and so as somebody who's alarmed, who came to the climate movement because I thought, from a professional point of view, I thought it was the biggest and most, it was the Mount Everest of research and marketing marketing challenges, right, given how difficult it is. But also from a personal point of view, I just didn't think I could look my kids in the face in 20 years' time as, you know, we were, as the, you know, Great Barrier Reef was gone and the koala could only be seen in, you know, zoos, and say, yeah, I didn't do anything. So that was a kind of personal moral challenge or personal moral thing that brought me to climate change. But I don't want to assume any of those other groups feel that way. If there'd be lots of parents in those other segments, and who am I to say you don't care about your kids if you don't care about climate change? It was a really important personal motivation for me, and there was a professional motivation and also a feeling that I could make a contribution. And everybody can, based on whatever their existing skills are.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so the big thing for the alarmed group, and the good thing is the alarmed group at the moment is about 24% of the population.
Awesome.
And combined with the concerned and the alert, we're over 50% of the population and growing. So our challenge is to maintain our own enthusiasm and stamina in the movement, in what we do, to understand the other segments and get better at talking to people who aren't like us.
And I think you touched on something really nice just then about being empathetic and non-judgmental towards people who are, you know, now that you're telling me that like 70 or more percent or 90% of the population believes in some form of climate change, they're just kind of like in different levels. It's a lot. It takes a lot to be alarmed about climate change. Like, it's quite draining and, you know, it can be quite stressful at times, and it is a lot to read about this stuff constantly. And like, I know I feel down about it often. So I totally understand why people probably don't want to engage constantly. Like, they have other things going on in their life. And I think that's one of the really nice things about your book, is that it goes through these 8 very strong key emotions. But it, throughout it all, it's like we're all just people and we're all trying to do our best. Like, cut the judgment, put a lot more empathy in, like, let's have like more real connected emotional conversations about this issue.
Tessa, that's exactly right. That I think it's a really good starting point and something constantly to come back to. In the climate compass segmentation, there's a segment called disengaged. And so it sounds like a very pejorative term. We couldn't think of anything else to do about it. Small group. That doesn't mean that other groups haven't got a level of disengagement, but this group is characterised by the fact that not only they disengage from the climate change message, they disengage from politics generally. The demographic skews, so there's lots of people in that group, but it tends to skew 70% women between the ages of 30 and 50 on part-time work, mostly precarious work, with caring responsibilities. And one of the things I say when I look at that category, having done research with women in that category a lot, is to judge them because they won't engage with climate change when they're already understandably massively overwhelmed because of a whole range of things beyond their control, you know, the gender pay gap, you know, I mean, the unequal distribution of care in the home, whatever it be. They might be, and not a lot of them living in the inner city, in the outer suburbs. These are women who are under extraordinary financial, financial and personal stress. They're just trying to find their kids' shoes in order to get them to school, to say to them, it's your responsibility to solve climate change and where's your keeper cup? I mean, that's just utterly ridiculous. So I think, how do we make, for this group of women, their lives easier, financially or whatever, in terms of climate solutions, and how do we find different ways to communicate with them? And the last thing we want them to do is feel guilty or shameful because they're not engaging with the climate movement, or judge them as somehow they don't care about other people, because in fact their entire lives are dedicated to caring for older parents, or so they've got, you know, a lot of caring responsibilities. So while the term is disengaged, and for activists like me and for like you, we would say, why are you disengaged is a huge issue, why don't you care? Understanding the situation that they're in, the lives that they're in, the biggest thing to say with them is, you know, if governments genuinely invest in renewable energy will be cheaper for you. You know, there's a lot of really interesting stuff done with the idea of building social and public housing already built with renewable infrastructure. So the one thing that they don't have to worry about is the power bill, which can often be really significant for them. So how do we make climate change solutions making their life easier today? And the last thing we want to do is judge them for being, you know, not committed to the cause, because they're already extraordinarily committed to caring for people around them with not that much social and economic support in doing that.
Mm. And yeah, you just said something as well that made me think of another question I had for you.
Yep.
It might be a bit political, but I feel like there was a shift in kind of the environmental movement, or not the environmental movement, but like the way environmentalism was kind of pitched to people. Mm-hmm. It went from being this kind of very corporate thing to then the individual.
Yeah.
And you just then saying, oh, you know, that person didn't bring their keep cup, like, you know, let's give them the stink eye in the cafe. It's like, yeah, it really frustrates me that it has become about the individual and like, do I recycle? Do I compost? Do I have my keep cup? All things that are great, but ultimately that probably won't shift climate change. And it's like, it's a really clever but evil shift.
Exactly.
That it's like, it makes people feel guilty. It makes them feel shameful. It makes them disengage. And it's so frustrating. Exactly
right. Yeah, no, I write a bit about that in the book. But the most interesting example of this, I've just been watching unfold on social media, and occasionally social media can deliver on this, is that Shell put out this little tweet saying, what do you think you can do to reduce your emissions? And just got utterly, you know what I mean? And if you're on Twitter, and if that's a platform that you like, go and look at how people have responded to this tweet.
Annihilated.
How dare you ask us a question about how we're reducing our emissions. So you're exactly right. So, I mean, one of the, and I am never one to, you know, individual actions scaled up, supported by government, in a long-term campaign around behaviour change can be extraordinarily effective. A good example in Australia is that over the last, I would say, 15 years, we've gone from the broader community thinking that water, you know, that water in Australia is not an issue, we can kind of use it, abuse it, to realising now that we actually, like, water is a scarce commodity, and that at times of drought and times when there are, you know, low reserves of water, we all need to play our part, right? So in Australia, there's generally been widespread support for things like water restrictions. Now, we could we do more? Absolutely. But there's this kind of recognition that if we all do something small together, there's kind of importance of shared social you know, behavior change and signals from people around us about the way to behave, then that can be hugely effective. But without that government leading, providing support, particularly for people who don't have the capacity to, you know, their issues and they need support in terms of that behavior change, then it's, you know, it's kind of making us responsible for a structural problem that we didn't create. Yeah. And that's a real problem. And then at its worst, it makes climate change something that our only power is as an individual consumer. And so we think, oh, we've got to pay more for all these environmental products or do things differently and everything. And so that becomes this idea, I have to pay for a social, economic and environmental problem I didn't cause with more money and more time spent on that. And you can understand why people who are overwhelmed, don't have access to that money, reject that message.
Yeah.
So it's a balance. It's not to say, and, you know, we've seen examples, whether it be, you know, reducing plastic or doing some, you know, things around waste, like I said, around water, you know, big campaigns for getting small actions from individuals and households and communities to scale that up. That has been incredibly important. Things like community power plans, which are, you know, communities jumping up around Australia, starting their own microgrids and all the rest of it, that's great.
Yeah.
But if it just becomes about you, your individual decisions every day as a consumer, then we've lost the larger argument. And so you're absolutely right. Mm. It's not about you keep a cup. That's what I'm saying, don't get one.
No, of course not. That was
One here, but every now and then, but you know, every now and then when I forget my keeper.
It's tiny.
It is tiny. Well, I started them. Do you know what I started them? The massive, I have three kids, you know, what is it called? Baby Chino, the kind of avalanche of baby Chinos. And so yeah, I bought two of these. So, and that's why it's pink. you know, so that's not to say don't have a keeper cup, but remember when you forget your keeper cup, remember that tweet from Shell asking you about reducing your emissions. Give yourself a break and go on Twitter and troll Shell for a while about the absolute audacity about asking us how we're going to reduce our emissions.
Yeah. I wanted to move on to talking about your book more specifically, because it's written in a really interesting way. You kind of flow through eight very key and strong human emotions. Mm. Starts with guilt, goes to fear, anger, despair, loss, denial, hope, and then finishes on love. Mm-hmm. So yeah, all of these are very natural responses to something like climate change. But I'm curious, when we're talking about climate change, which of these emotions are detrimental to the cause, and which are the ones that work best?
Yeah, so that's very much like the question that I had when I first came into working on the book. And so I remember going, when I went to Yale, I talked to the very, very clever man, Anthony Lerzeritz, who runs the program for the last 12 years. And I said to him, well, you know, is fear effective? Is, you know, guilt effective? And he kept saying to me, Rebecca, it depends on who you're talking to, about what, and what you want to get them to do, right? So, and it was a really important insight because it made me realise that all of these emotions that we have as human beings serve a purpose and can sometimes serve an incredibly useful purpose, but if allowed to run rampant, can be destructive. So think about something like anger. Collective moments of anger and frustration expressed by people on an issue have driven social movements and social change from as long as they've been around. You know, the student climate strikers would not have taken to the streets if they were mildly annoyed. They were, it's like, no protest happens because people are mildly annoyed. People might go on Twitter if they're mildly annoyed, but they don't get angry. They don't leave their houses and paint signs if they're just mildly annoyed. So all of these emotions can be useful. They can sometimes be more useful with some people rather than others. And it depends on what you want to get people to do. So one of the things that was really clear, going through all these emotions, going through all the psychological research, and then almost going back to first principles, what is it that fear, anger, guilt does for us? Like, what is the social, you know, and personal outcome, right? What is the driver that makes you feel these emotions at a kind of gut level? And what does it do for you? Going back to that gave me some clarity. And I've got to say, of all the emotions, the one that I think is almost irredeemable is shame. Guilt can be important. Guilt when tied to responsibility. Guilt about the kind of world that we were living in, and that almost like an anticipated sense of guilt for me, that if I didn't make a contribution to an issue I knew was fundamental to my children's well-being in the future, my children and all the children around them and the community around them, the anticipated sense of guilt that I wasn't going to do something about that, it made me a climate activist. So guilt can be useful if connected to responsibility and action. Shame's a bit different, because when you shame somebody, you make them feel bad as a person, intrinsically bad as a person, rather than, oh, you've done something or you're not doing something and you should do something. Often shame is so wounding, right? It's so alienating. When people feel shame, they turn in on themselves. So it's probably the only emotion that if somebody said, we want to shame people into doing something about it, I'd just be I'd really be careful. I think that shame only works for a small group of people who were already on board, right? So I'm not really interested in thinking about emotional appeals that work for anybody else other than the people we need to convince to start voting with climate in mind, to start acting with climate in mind, start going to their banks, superannuation funds, employers, and saying, what are you doing? Right. So shame's probably the only one. All the rest of them can be really effective and important if deployed well, with a mind for who are you talking to, about what, and what do you want to get them to do. And I kind of feel like, and you know, in the conversations and the emails we've been having before this podcast, the only other emotion that I think can be really can backfire. I thought that I'd end the book on hope, but actually hope's the second last chapter, because hope can be a trap.
Yeah. Why is that?
Because we hope somebody else will rescue us. It's a kind of, there is no shining knight. Elon Musk is not going to jump on a horse and save us with whatever crazy invention.
Yeah.
Oh, the Tesla's wonderful, but he's a bit of a freak. No, I mean, what I'm going to say is we are not going to be rescued by some really, really, really wealthy billionaire who suddenly is worrying about climate and is going to, you know, do whatever.
Yeah. It is a fine line, isn't it? Because you want to have some hope. You want to, you know, look towards the solutions and try and take a positive slant. But then the flip side of that is becoming, yeah, like you said, disillusioned that someone else will fix it, or, oh, that these really clever battery operated cars will they'll save the day.
Yeah, so we're not, what I think about in terms of hope, and it's even different, because when I started to write the book, I was starting to be engaged with the climate movement and with climate solutions, but I was still at the beginning of that process, and I imagine I'll always be. Whenever I find myself hoping, it's at about 2 a.m. in the morning, where I'm like, oh, I hope it won't be, you know, I've maybe read some climate science or whatever, and I'm like, oh, hope. Like, I just so hope it won't be that bad. Like, and so I use it in that, which is basically me trying to get myself back to sleep and soothe my anxieties. What I feel when I see, you know, I had the privilege to launch independent federal MP Helen Haynes has released a kind of a community power plan.
Oh, cool.
And as part of that, I was exposed to these extraordinary community, you know, power projects from around Australia, different kinds of communities, particularly in regional Australia, coming together saying, we want our business or suburb or whatever to be not only not producing emissions, but providing cheap energy for schools and important community businesses and, you know, football stadiums and all the rest of it. And all these different amazing technologies. So, you know, And I just thought, wow, that's so great. So it's less about hope and it's more about enthusiasm about the opportunity and the power that happens, the power, pardon the pun, of what happens when like-minded people, and like-minded in that they have like-minded in terms of the solutions, they might have very different views about climate change, come together and say, this is going to be good for us, we're going to make it happen.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's quite hope. It's that sense of possibility. And that energy that comes when people say, we're going to make this happen. So that's what I get. And then I get an enormous amount of optimism. And I think optimism and hope are slightly different
for
me. So I walk away from engaging with those communities, learning about the extraordinary technology. A friend of mine who's a marine biologist does a lot of stuff on seaweed. I thought seaweed was something that just, you know,
I love seaweed.
Annoyed me when I swam and, you know, was wrapped around my sushi roll. But the capacity of seaweed in terms of feed for cattle to kind of reduce their emissions and the importance of these extraordinary underworld forests, you know, and the importance of something like seaweed. And so I get that's enthusiasm and optimism and opportunity, which is different from hope. Whenever I'm hoping, it's because it's me trying to create a kind of cognitive barrier before I fall into despair.
Yeah.
Then I have to go back to the solutions, which is less about hope and, like I said, more about enthusiasm, optimism, excitement, and that sense of activism when you see other people just getting on and making it happen and you think, well, I better do it too.
Yeah. Enthusiasm is it's a very strong, and it's also very, it rubs off. I feel like if someone's really enthusiastic about something, it's much more likely going to rub off on the person next to them than if they're like, oh, you know, this is really shit, you should also be mad about this. It's like negativity brings people down. We're already in this kind of, I've heard you speak about this kind of like interlocked crises, you know, with COVID and with now the bushfires that happened prior to COVID. Like, there's a lot of anxiety and enthusiasm seems like that is the smartest way to go about discussing these kind of issues.
That's exactly right. So I realize that there are different levels of hope, and a hope that is about somebody else will solve this or it won't be quite as bad as they say it is not really hope. It's a different form of denial. A kind of active hope that's really about optimism, enthusiasm, and potentially too isn't naive about the challenges we face, even if we manage to pull it off, right? So even if we manage to pull off this transition in the time that we have, there is still so much has been lost and so much will continue to be lost. What we're fighting for is a livable world for us and our children, not just in the long term but in the short term. I don't want to say set in stone, but that isn't something we can reverse. And again, it's a naive hope and optimism that thinks that we can. What we're doing is fighting to retain the things we can retain, with a hope that some of the things that potentially have, particularly in things like animal extinction, we are finding that some, you know, as many animals as we're losing. If we do manage to nail a few things in a few places, some surprising things can happen. So we're creating the opportunity not just to retain the things that we want to retain and create a livable world, but opening up the possibility that we could have some lovely surprises as part of it. But it's still a challenge. So a hope that is I'll say that again. That's my parcel. That's not my. That's something else. It's a rug.
Oh, right.
It's not the table they were bringing.
So it's not the table. I was like, I got excited for a moment.
No. If I have a feeling, I've told my children, we've eaten on the floor so many times. I've told them the table's coming today. They have no hope. I still have hope that it will arrive. Okay, go back to what I was saying. So a hope that is realistic and gets its mind across the science, but that is active regardless, is the hope that we need. That's what we need.
And the final chapter is love, which is so nice. And it's one of my favorite chapters. Did you end on this because it is such an active and usable emotion, or because...
Yeah, and you know, Tessa, it's very hard. All of the people that know me before I wrote this book, because I'm not particularly an emotional person. I'm a highly, I'm an academic, highly rational person.
Yeah.
When people get all touchy-feel. I hate rom-coms, you know. And I'm not one of those people.
Pragmatic.
Right? I hate, those kind of inspirational posters.
Yeah.
I'm not one of those. I'm not romantic at all.
Well, you wrote a very emotional book. I'm surprised by that.
I wrote an incredibly emotional book. And I suppose, look, while I'm not romantic, I am a bit, in the extent to which anything can make me emotional, it's my kids, and not just my kids, the generation that they're part of. Yeah, I mean, since I started my career defending Generation Y, which were getting a, really bad rap, and actually I wrote a very positive book about what I thought they were like, and I just really feel a duty of care, not just to my children, but to their generation. So it's not surprising that the students' climate strike was the thing that made me go, kind of tipped me over the edge towards climate activism. So I suppose what I feel is what I see, not only in the work that I'm doing now, but in the work previously, is the extraordinary capacity when people come together to protect something they love or care for or value. Now, that can be very personal, but more powerfully, it can be a community that make a decision, which is, this is really important to us and we're going to throw ourselves at solving this problem.
Mm.
Often the most exciting examples of that are very local, but they can be scaled up, and they're a case study of what can happen when people really come together to make a decision that they're going to do something. So I think that can be, because that love and that fierce desire to protect something you value, care for, love, it can be more positive than hope, because just hope or hope that somebody else will solve it, there's something about love when you love something which invites your own involvement, invites your own activism. Right. If you really care that your kid gets a good education, you're going to try and find a good school. You're going to get really involved in their homework. You're going to, make a personal investment about the outcome. So love, care, whatever you want to call it, when a community mobilises around what they value, love and care for, that can be incredibly powerful, and it can cut through all the other barriers that we have around climate change, whether they be political, whether they be social or otherwise. And in that chapter, you saw I used a very kind of small but quite powerful example of what happens when a whole lot of bird watchers in America are told that the way to protect the birds that they've been watching for generations is to do something about climate change. And it worked. And so I think one of the things I do a lot of consulting at the moment with communities that want to talk about climate change. And I say the starting point of the conversation is not always the climate science. In fact, it often isn't, because that's what people expect. There's a whole lot of I don't understand this, or I've heard this before.
Yeah.
Start the conversation. What do you value? What do you love?
Yeah.
What are you worried is under threat? What do you want to retain? What kind of future do you see and want for you and your family, your children, your community? And then think about how climate action, renewable energy, biodiversity, protecting ecosystems, green space, clean water, clean air, more jobs coming out of renewable energy, more profits in the community. How can any of those things not fit in to the thing you want to love, value, protect, care for?
Yeah. And that's a really nice separation from the very, what I find mainstream message to do with climate change is get political, vote, get political, get active, vote for this person. And I kind of fear at the moment that the politicization of this issue has turned a lot of people away. Because yes. within our media, we are seeing the same kind of, you talk about like the jingle. It's like this just like jingle of like climate change, warming, 1.5 degrees. You just hear these like buzzwords and they're just thrown at you, and you become very, yeah, desensitized. Have you seen that represented in your research?
Oh, it is. And in Australia and America, it's particularly politically polar. There's been an active campaign for the anti-climate change forces, talk about anti as in anti-climate action forces, to politicise the issue, to make it a left-right issue. Yeah. So it becomes less about what is the science really telling us and what are the policy options and what's the smart economic decision to be made, which is what it is now, to this idea about culture wars and left and right. I mean, one of the things is, and, you know, I had an interesting, somebody reviewed the book, and I don't read reviews, I get my agent to read them. And she said it criticised it as being all about emotion and not about politics, the book, that it wasn't talking about structural change. And I just didn't write that kind of book. There's a lot of other fantastic books out there about about how you get politically active on climate change. Read Naomi Klein. She's a great writer. So I think that I would never say, and I did a PhD in politics. I'm involved in the Labor Party.
You're a very political person.
I'm very political. Voting can be an act of love, but when it comes, like as in I am voting to protect the things that matter to me, right? I would never say don't vote. I would never say don't get involved in a political advocacy organisation. I would never say don't get political, don't protest. The thing that brought me to climate action was a large-scale political protest. All right, there are moments where I think I'm going to cut off my hair and join Extinction Rebellion. They don't last for a long time because I like my hair. One of the few things that bring the boys to my yard, I've got to say at the moment. So I get that, but I also understand, and I've seen it after years of researching people, that if you start with the science and the politics, with the people we need to convince, you will not continue the conversation. If you start the conversation where they want to be and what resonates with them, you can have a chance of continuing that conversation to perhaps leave them sooner rather than later to the political and other acts of advocacy that we need. Talk to your superannuation fund. Seriously talk to your bank. Vote. Talk to any level of government, whether it be local, state, federal. Have these conversations. Have these conversations with your employer. Have these conversations in your professional organisation. Right, so those are the conversations. But you for those people who still believe in the climate science, want action, but are turned off by what they see as a divisive politics around climate change, which they don't want to be part of, that political appeal just is, it's not the starting point. The science and the politics is not the starting point with those people. Other things are. I'll give you a really small example. One of the things that the segmentation shows us is that people who are cautious and disengaged on climate change, when we ask them who would influence you most in a conversation about climate change, who do you want to hear from? They say friends and family. They don't say politicians or climate scientists or, you know, that's who they want to hear from. They want to hear from people they trust in everyday life in a way that makes climate change relevant to them. But if you're alarmed or alert or even concerned, you're happy to hear about it from politics and, you know, ABC documentaries and all the rest of it. So again, I'm not saying don't get political. I'm saying if we are going to convince people, if we're serious about the art of persuasion, we have to understand where people are and keep the conversation going. The only way we do not break the climate science with the same tools we've been bashing away at for 30 years with these people. So that's what I would say. And to tell you the truth, like I said, I have a lot of alarm. Everybody in my social circle is alarmed. So I feel like I know how to talk to those people. We sit there, you know, and we talk about that kind of stuff. My professional background, my skills and my interest is in talking to people who don't feel the way I do about climate change and to do that as effectively as possible. And the starting point is what we love, what we value, what we want for our community, not this is the politician you've got to talk to, and this is the petition you've got to sign, and
Yeah. It also sounds like the starting point is listening first and then talking, listening to understand what it is that person, you know, not coming in with, I'm a greenie and I think climate change is this real big thing. Like, here's all the things I have to tell you. It's like, what do you like? What do you like? What? Yeah. Listening first. I think maybe we do too much talking, maybe. I don't know.
Certainly understanding where someone comes from.
Yeah.
On the issue. And more importantly, one of the things I often do is say, well, what is it that you don't, when you hear about climate change or when you're listening to a conversation, what turns you off? Like, what's the thing that you don't like? What stops you from engaging and listening? That's always fascinating.
What are those things?
Well, for most people, so it's interesting. So one thing is this idea that, and one of the things we do, and the reality is it's in the science, that if in 20 or 30 years' time we don't do something, this is this apocalyptic vision of our world that's going to happen. That terrifies people.
Yeah.
It terrifies all of us, but different people respond differently. And in the work that I've done prior to climate change, when I've ever asked people to project into the future, probably the most, that, I mean, you know, so disengaged people, if you think about those disengaged mums, you know, those women with all of that responsibility, the future is just Friday night. Like, how we get to Friday night.
Yeah.
Understandably, right? You want to tell them about what's going to happen in 20 years' time. That is just too much for people. And I've spent years listening to people trying to get them to project into the future, and they say, I'm just trying to get to the end of the year. Or so it's about this sense of control and agency in their life, right? So we do need to be honest with people about what's at stake. And this goes back to the chapter on fear. Again, I thought fear appeals don't work, but we do need to give people a really strong sense of what can be, what has been lost and what can be lost. We just don't want to double down on it 700 times.
Yeah.
The reason why it's important to give that, and I write it, have a chapter on loss, actually, I talk about the importance of loss, is that people don't change unless they think that something's at stake. It's like the flip side to love. We act to protect something we love, but also because we feel that something might be lost, right? So we have that there is a threat. So we do need to be honest about that, but we don't need to go crazy. So most of the time people, so what are they had about climate change? They feel that it's all about motivating people to behave differently based on fear, not on necessarily gain. Fear of what's going to happen in the future rather than what could I gain today, or what could we gain as a community today by action? They feel it's a left-right issue, so that's the other thing. We just need more and more and more unlikely conservative voices coming out on climate. This is why the app, you know, one of the things I call out constantly, even though we're not on the same page on so much in terms of politics, is the New South Wales Environment Minister, Matt Cain. Like, he's out there, right? He's a conservative out there constantly talking about climate change, constantly talking about the benefits, not shrinking from that at all. So we do need to look at more conservative voices, whether they be farmers, whether they, whoever can appeal to people who find, who think that climate change is something that you only care about if you're progressive.
Mm.
So the politicisation, the extreme fear base, and the other thing that upsets people, and it goes back to what we were talking before, this idea that it's all on me. You know, and it's this individual thing, and it's all about my actions, and that. So we really need to do as much as we possibly can to emphasize that this is, you are one in a larger network of people who are supporting you.
Yeah.
And I suppose the other thing, and this is the thing I've been doing a bit and I want to do more, is collect as many examples of climate solutions in action today to give people a tangible sense of what's possible and a sense of, oh, actually, I didn't know that. Isn't that great? Isn't that terrific? So, you know, whether it's a exciting new, you know, manufacturing of batteries in South Australia, employing people who once worked in car manufacturing and don't have jobs, right? So, and that's entirely run through renewable energy, employing people, creating a form of renewable energy, employing people who weren't getting jobs before. Isn't that terrific?
Yeah.
Or whether it's people coming up with great new ways to revitalise the Great Barrier Reef, whatever that is. You know, you have to give people a sense of what's possible.
Yeah.
And rather than making it seem quite intangible, so intangible, too much focus on the individual, too much politicisation and too much catastrophisation. Those would be the four things.
Mm.
That the people who are already on board and cannot be convinced, remember, only 9%, everybody else. So part of communication is how can you still tell the truth, which you have to do. You know, you don't want to say, oh, this climate change thing, it's going to be, look, as long as we all put solar panels on and Elon Musk comes to Australia and visits every year, it'll be fine. We can't say that, right? So how do we be honest brokers but realise that those are barriers, and how do we find ways not to trigger people on those questions, find ways to circumvent them, try and find different organisations to be part of the climate movement who can talk effectively in that way to those people with those kind of triggers or problems in mind.
Yeah. I just have one final question. I hope
I promised I'd give you short answers and I did.
No, they're awesome answers. I love them. And we've covered pretty much everything that I wanted to touch on, except I just have one final question, which is in relation to social media.
Yeah.
Because it is such a huge part of, you know, a lot of everyone's lives these days. And it's also the place where we get a lot of our news.
Yes.
But it has become this very... yeah, this very like hybrid social but also political and news kind of platform now. I'm curious if this, you know, what we're talking about now, kind of how we converse and how we go about talking about climate change, if that is, would you recommend that to be applicable to social media, or is there a different kind of tactic?
Yeah, it's difficult. So I suppose I would talk mainly about Twitter in this respect. So The research is mixed on how social media frames climate change and so there's certainly evidence that shows it's added to the politicisation.
Yeah.
And it makes people who are concerned about climate change but more silent and in the middle think, oh, I can't talk about it because I just can't keep up with that bomb-throwing stuff, that social media stuff. So it can re-emphasise the climate science. So this kind of polarisation on social media and kind of narkiness and trolling can make people who are concerned about climate change but not confident about talking about it shy away. So what it can do is reinforce the climate silence, which is absolutely critical that we have to break.
Yes.
I understand why people... And the other thing I would say is that in all the research that I do and in some of the research that's been done globally, people still get really important information about climate change from Twitter. So some of the examples of really effective renewable energy projects in Australia I get from Twitter, I find out from Twitter. So it is an important news source for those of us who are using it, who are interested. I suppose I think everybody who's concerned about climate change and wants to engage ends up having to have their own kind of personal rules about how to engage. If it's really driving you nuts and making you unhappy and draining your energy, leave. I wouldn't want us all to leave. I've left Facebook for a whole range of reasons, but I've stayed on Twitter and stayed on Instagram because I just kind of feel like if we do not want to abandon that terrain for the trolls and the deniers.
Yeah.
That being said, I have a couple of rules. I never, ever argue with deniers on Twitter. I just block them.
I just don't do it. You don't have the energy. You don't have the time.
Limited energy, right? And I know 9%. Where do I put my energy?
The pragmatic part of your brain.
Pardon?
The pragmatic part of your brain. You're like, this is just a 9%. This is just a data. I know this is.
Now, I really admire people who are prepared to challenge them effectively through comedy or through whatever. Go for it. I would not say don't do it if they've got the energy to do it and that's how they've decided to spend their time, their climate activism, go for it. The second thing I do is I amplify and retweet surprising conservative voices on climate. I don't think I've ever retweeted, as much as I love Naomi Klein and all the kind of the conventional climate voices, Mm. I don't retweet them. If it's somebody from the conservative side of politics or a surprising messenger around politics, I retweet them. Because we need to amplify those voices and we need to support them. If they're stepping out, remember one time, one of the first things I did when I came to climate activism is I remember finding a speech, I think it was by a South Australian MP, who got up in Parliament and said, I actually dismissed the climate science for a long time and then I really, really delved into it and now I actually think, it is true. And I was wrong and we need to do something about this. And I think one of my first retweets. So it takes a lot to say that, in especially in the conservative side. That's what I do. So I think about how can I effectively, what do I know needs to happen?
Mm.
And know that I personally know, like I said, 9% of the population don't argue with deniers on Twitter. And I know that we need different voices in the climate movement and we need to amplify them. I suppose my only retweeting of conventional climate activists on Twitter would be people of colour. So anything to do with what's happening in the Torres Strait, which is still woefully underappreciated by both the community and by governments, I do that. And there's some fantastic, fantastic women of colour writing about climate change in Australia and globally. So I do that because they can say it better than me. So that's what I do. So we're kind of strategic about Twitter in terms of what I do. And so people have to kind of, so it is important. It can reinforce the climate silence and the polarisation, which is why you should think about what is it that I can do on this social media platform which defies those two things.
Mm.
The moment you get into an unedifying shit fight with a denier on climate and somebody sees it, it just reinforces this idea that that's what the climate conversation should be about.
Totally.
But not only is it you're never going to win that conversation and actually it feels shitty, you potentially could be reinforcing that message, which is that's what people do when they talk about climate change.
Yeah, totally. Oh, it's a scary world out there sometimes, online world.
That's right. Well, hopefully it'll be slightly less scary in about 24 hours. So let's cross
up. Yes,
we get a good result.
Oh, well, we've gone 5 minutes over, so
that's all right.
It's time to finish. Yes. Yeah. Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Tessa, that was a great conversation. Thank you so much. I'm glad you enjoyed the book and that you found it useful.
Wow. That was an awesome conversation. I really, really learned a lot. And isn't Rebecca great? So many amazing insights and interesting comments. I hope you guys enjoyed that. You can follow Rebecca and her work on Twitter and Instagram. And of course, if you're interested to get a hold of the book, I really recommend it. It's a great read. I guess this is the part where I say subscribe if you like, or you can follow on social media, the Nature Between Us podcast. And I hope you have a great couple of weeks and be back soon. Bye.